Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week from Bristol University, second year film student Max Langer talks about the Bristol bus protest Facebook page, and he's now started a petition too to get Bristol's buses sorted out for students and everyone else in the city. First bus, I hope you're paying attention. And also Christopher Black, he's an international criminal lawyer from Toronto in Canada. He writes for the New Eastern Outlook website and globalresearch.ca, two excellent international analysis websites, talking about things you just won't hear here on the mainstream press, the mass media here in Britain. And when exactly are Bush and Blair going to be standing trial for war crimes? Remember the illegal invasion of Iraq? Well, that was 15 years ago, and millions have been displaced, tens if not hundreds of thousands killed in that part of the world since, but still no trials. We hear from Christopher Black. He's an international criminal lawyer based in Toronto in Canada. He writes for globalresearch.ca, which is a Canadian website, and also for the New Eastern Outlook, NEO. Those are two websites which discuss international issues, the sort of thing that you will not see, I'm afraid, anywhere on the mass media here in the UK. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio, one word, .co.uk, and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. If you've got a story or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
I'm Max Langer. I'm a second year film student at the University of Bristol.
So what got you interested in the transport, apart from the fact that you have to use the buses?
Well, it's been kind of a slow build-up of things over the last 2.5 years that I've lived in Bristol. It's been the constant terrible service. And then the last couple of months has kind of seen all these different things pile on top.
Before we talk about the recent future, generally, as a student arriving in the city for the first year or so, what was your experience of the buses like? What sort of incidents do you remember?
Well, constantly having buses turning up late, as everybody I think in the city has, but a few that come to mind is actually at the weekend. I was getting the bus home and late at night on the Sunday evening, unfortunately bought the wrong ticket. I got a short ticket rather than a long ticket, so the bus driver kicked me off and I had a 4.5 mile walk home despite offering to buy the correct ticket from him. So that was about 3 degrees that evening, so not the best experience of my life.
So just to explain the difference between a short and a long ticket.
So a short ticket is up to, I'm not actually sure the exact distance, a couple of kilometres, and then a long ticket is anything above that. So I had the short ticket, so after 3-4 kilometres, whatever it is, the bus driver pulled up and said I needed a different ticket.
So hang on a minute, because surely some of the students tried to scam this. They'll buy a short ticket where actually they really need a long ticket. So the bus driver is within his rights to say, sorry, you know, you've got the wrong ticket, you're going to have to get off here.
Yeah, he's completely within his rights to tell you if you've got the wrong ticket. He doesn't. I don't think he should have the right to drop you off miles away from home late on a Sunday evening in the cold, especially if you offer to buy the correct ticket from him and basically give them extra money.
What about the whole idea of using cash and not using cash? Because they don't like cash, do they?
No, they don't like cash, and I think that's kind of reasonable. They want to get people on and off the buses as quickly as possible. So using contactless, using apps seems reasonable. Only a couple of years ago, you could only use cash, and that was just a ridiculous system to have, especially in the 21st century.
Have you ever found a situation where you're waiting for a bus and just no bus turns up? I mean, obviously that, when it's one of the late ones in the evening or the last bus, that can be horrific.
Yeah, that happens quite frequently. I've had to walk home up, you know, an hour or more walking just because the bus never turned up, despite the board saying there should be one.
So these boards as well, they are quite fairly newfangled for us oldies innovation, where they tell you a bus is coming. How accurate are they?
Well, you'd think that the technology around these days, that they'd be able to make them pretty accurate. You know, you can have trackers on all your buses and work out how far away they are. Google Maps tells you how long it's going to take you to get anywhere, including what traffic there is. But they don't seem to be very accurate. They often say that there's a bus coming that never materializes. Sometimes buses just drop off the board without any warning, and then sometimes they drop off, so you think, oh, my bus isn't coming, start walking, and then the bus drives past you 5 minutes later. So there seems to be no correlation there at all.
What about choice? Because the whole idea of privatising buses is that there is some sort of choice. Do you have any choice in which buses you use?
No, because in reality, every route has one service provider on each route. So there is no choice. There is no market for buses. There is simply the bus that is there. And you can't, if I don't want to use a first bus, then that means that I can't use the majority of buses in the city. And that means I can't travel around the city.
And in your experience, is there any kind of feedback when buses are frequently cancelled? Do the operators get told, sorry, you're not operating this bus anymore because you're not doing a good enough job?
Well, there's plenty of... They always have a service number. I've never actually tried to call it because, frankly, I hear enough people complaining about it and there has never been a market change in it. So I think they probably do get enough grief. You can go look at First Bus on Twitter and you'll see plenty of it. But the fact is that they are not accountable to us, so they don't need to change.
What about the apps? They brought these along in the last few years. The idea being to supposedly speed people's way on where they use their phone to get on the bus. Have you used those? Do they work? My problem with that is that what happens if your battery runs out like a couple of minutes before the bus turns up? It means you may not be able to get on the bus. But anyway, what's your experience of using the app?
I think the app overall is a good idea. It should speed up boarding. It allows you to plan ahead what ticket you're going to have. Yes, battery is always a problem. I'm actually a bit worried if I'll get home after this because of my phone battery.
Well, we've got a charger in the corner in case you need to charge it.
Cheers.
Anyway.
But yeah, the only problem we have with the apps so far is that they don't seem to be overly reliable. There's been a couple of times where the app just won't open, and so I've had to miss a bus because I can't get a ticket out.
Can you not get on the bus and say, look, driver, my app is in the process of opening, and when it does, my ticket will... I can get my ticket. Are the drivers sympathetic to that sort of thing?
Well, some are absolutely lovely, but you are basically rolling the dice as to whether you're going to have a sympathetic bus driver or a bus driver who's more worried about keeping to his schedule, which is kind of reasonable.
What about the last couple of months? Because there have been quite a lot of problems with the buses, and I imagine the students, you know, you guys have been subject to that. Hopefully you had a bit of time away from the city during the holidays, but what's it been like since you've been back?
Well, I've been here all summer, so I've experienced it all. It's the last couple of months has been an issue. First Bus have been saying that they haven't been able to recruit enough drivers, and so there's been lots of services missing, buses being cancelled, buses being late.
You know, just thinking about it, it's been the same with the trains, hasn't it? A lot of the train operators saying, sorry, we just don't have the drivers to run the train, so you're not going to go to work today until an hour after you're supposed to be there. So isn't this a sort of general thing across the industry?
Yeah, it seems that while large swathes of the world have managed to get public transport right, we simply haven't.
And also, of course, we've got a massive queue of unemployed people. So you would think that it wouldn't have been that difficult to recruit people. Unless they're paying the drivers peanuts, I can't see any other reason why they couldn't recruit people.
I don't know. It might be down to that. It might be people's just perception of the kind of work that bus driving and train driving is. I don't know why they can't find people. There are plenty of people out there who are looking for jobs.
Okay, any other problems using the bus, or is it, you know, apart from the odd one not turning up because there's no drivers been employed, any other problems, or has it been reasonably smooth?
Well, I think in the general trend that we've seen in the city, it's been relatively smooth, but that does not mean that it's been a good service.
Going downhill, basically.
Yes.
Okay, so what about your proposal and your petition? What exactly is this?
Yeah, so I started a petition because a couple of weeks ago, a woman from Brislington, I believe, started up a Facebook event for a protest because she was just fed up of the service that she was getting. And when I saw that, I was, you know, fist bumping the air. I was so happy.
At last, someone's doing something.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, because the council haven't, the government hasn't.
Yeah, so I think when it comes to that, the last thing you can do is really go out and just protest and say that this is not good enough.
Okay, I think we'd better say what the Facebook page is so people listening can find it.
So the event on Facebook for that protest is called the Bristol Bus Protest. And then for my petition, it's Take Control of Bristol's Buses. And that's also on Twitter and everywhere else.
Okay, so you're trying to get the issue raised, which is great.
Yeah.
But
what
would you propose? So it's very easy to criticise. The system is as it is. How would you do it, Max?
So my petition particularly points out the idea of bus franchising, which is how buses are run in London and it's how Manchester are hoping to improve their bus system as well. And basically what that means, bus franchising, it's not like rail franchising, there's no subsidies. It's the idea that the authority, so the West of England Combined Authority, you take control of transport, and Bristol City Council are able to choose the routes they want to run, choose the timetables they want to be run, choose the buses that they, the kind of environmental standards that they want to be enforced, and set the fares. And then they open that up to the private market, so to First Bus, to Bristol Community Transport, to all of these different bus companies, and say, who wants to run our bus services?
Well, I thought we were doing that already here in Bristol.
No, they're able to run whatever services they want. They can cut a service with a few weeks' notice. They can amend it so that they don't, so you can see.
Actually, they can cut a service with no notice. Yes. They just say, sorry, no drivers.
Well, usually they give a couple of days.
Usually they send at least one bus a day along a route, don't they?
Yeah, so they have free rein. That is what the deregulation of the bus service has done. They have free rein to do what they like. What my proposal is basically saying, we will ask you to provide our services. We know what we want. You then come along and say, yes, we'll provide that service.
Okay, so there's thousands and thousands of university students, tens of thousands of Bristolians using these buses. How come it's taken so long, do you think, to actually have some kind of citizens' movement? Because you would have thought that this is massively affecting, you know, everybody that uses the bus, tens of thousands of people's lives for years.
Yeah, to be honest, I don't know what it is. And I
so why didn't you beforehand? You've been putting up with this for 2.5 years yourself.
Yeah, I think it's just part of our nature that we kind of just think, oh, well, this is how it is. We've got way too used over the last couple of years of having bad public services. And I think we're starting to reach a breaking point in general about what our public services are achieving. And I think transport is not a bad place to start.
Okay, so there is a vacancy as transport cabinet member, as Vari Threlfall's just resigned, and it'd be interesting to get to the real bottom of why she's resigned. Marvin Rees, the mayor, has now apparently taken over that portfolio. If you were in Vari's shoes, or if the mayor appointed you saying, okay, we need someone to sort this out, Max, what would you do?
Well, the first thing I'd do is go to Tim Bowles, the regional mayor, and basically say, get your act together. He's been elected for
this
over
is the, a year. This is the Metro Mayor, isn't it?
The Metro Mayor, who was elected in May of 2017. He was saying that he was going to put out a bus strategy at the end of 2017. It is now being opened for public consultation early next year. So it is way behind schedule. And frankly, who's actually heard of Tim Bowles?
Has Tim got shares in First Group?
I don't know. Maybe that's something worth a Google.
Yes, it is. Yeah, or your other favourite search engine, yes. Not necessarily Google. Anyway, to follow this, Max, how do people find you and the Facebook protest? You better remind us again.
Yeah, so if you want to find the protest, it's called Bristol Bus Protest on Facebook. There's a Facebook event with over 1,000 people at the moment. If you want to find the petition, just go on to either Facebook or Twitter, and they're both at Bristol's Buses.
Max Langer, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Christopher Black. I'm a criminal lawyer based formerly in Toronto in Canada. I was born in the UK but spent most of my life in Canada. The last 30 years, I've been a criminal trial lawyer, and the last 20 years, I've been specializing in war crimes charges at the Hague Tribunal, the Yugoslavia Tribunal, and the Rwanda Tribunal, and various other cases related to those tribunals.
Now, the first thing I've got to say is, why haven't people like Tony Blair and George Bush been through this process? Because we keep hearing about various kind of minor African leaders that have been put on trial at The Hague and found guilty, including people from the former Yugoslavia. But the main war criminals, people like Tony Blair, George Bush, at least I suppose I should say alleged war criminals, Zippy Livni over in Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, people like that, they don't seem to have actually been called to account by the Hague Tribunal.
No. Well, there's two Hague Tribunals. There was the ad hoc tribunals, which were the Yugoslavia Tribunal and the Rwanda Tribunal. and also the Sierra Leone Tribunal for Charles Taylor, which also, they're all, those set up under UN auspices, were really controlled by the U.S. intelligence and NATO intelligence services in the U.S. And the Sierra Leone was basically U.S. Army operation.
So if you're working in The Hague, Christopher, I'm interested in why it is that people like Blair and Bush haven't been tried there. People like Zippy Livni, you know, responsible right. for massacres in the Middle East with the illegal invasion of Iraq.
Well, it's a very good question, but it means going into the fact that there are there's two sets of tribunals. There are the ad hoc UN tribunals, like the Yugoslav and Rwanda tribunals in Sierra Leone, which were under UN auspices, but really controlled by the Americans and other Western intelligence agencies. And then there's the International Criminal Court, which only has jurisdiction back to 2003. And it only has jurisdiction for those countries which are members of the Rome Treaty. The United States signed on but then withdrew. Russia and China are not members of the treaty. Syria is not. Afghanistan is not. Although Afghanistan has now given permission to the ICC to do investigations.
But 2003 was the year of the illegal Iraq invasion. Surely that's right. within the jurisdiction. Why haven't we seen Bush and Blair hauled before the courts?
Well, you can ask the prosecutors for the ICC that question, which we've asked, and they won't give you an answer. And it's quite clear that although the United States is not a member of the Rome Treaty and is not a member of that court, it controls, the EU and the United States control the staffing of that court, and they control key members of the staff in that court, and they really approve the judges, and the prosecutor is appointed by the Americans, no matter that they're not involved in it, technically speaking. The present prosecutor, Fatima Bensouda, was a former prosecutor at the Rwanda Tribunal and spent her career covering up U.S. war crimes in Africa. So they control the mechanisms of these tribunals, so there's no way that they can be charged, even if you could assume some sort of jurisdiction.
Well, this is worrying, isn't it? I mean, I was in Holland recently and speaking to just an average guy who was running a fish shop in the Hook of Holland, and he was saying how my father, who's still alive, his father lived through the war, and he said the thing my father always says is that the people in charge in The Hague now were on the wrong side during World War II. And although his father didn't fight, you know, that's one of the things he's absolutely adamant about, that the collaborators with the Nazis actually managed to get their fingers into the government pretty much straight after the Second World War. But anyhow, you've been involved, I know, at The Hague. You haven't given up, like many of us might, but you've been involved in both the Rwanda and the Yugoslavia cases. Can you just take us through those?
Well, I got involved first at the Rwanda Tribunal. My involvement came this way, briefly. When NATO attacked Yugoslavia, I was very angry about that in Toronto. We had big protests here against that, massive protests. So I looked around for some other lawyers. What can we do as lawyers to try and do something against NATO? And there was a group here led by Michael Mandel, a professor at a law school here, who wrote the famous book, How America Gets Away with Murder. He led our team, and we filed war crimes charges against NATO at the Yugoslav Tribunal in The Hague. Because at that time, the prosecutor was Louise Arbour, who was one time my professor of criminal law and was a colleague of these other guys. Anyway, she turned us down, froze us out, and acted really as a policewoman for NATO and charged Milosevic just at the time when the French and the Germans wanted to stop the attack and conclude some sort of peace deal. So she arranged with Madeleine Albright and Bill Clinton an indictment against Milosevic, so he became a quote-unquote war criminal, and therefore could not be negotiated with, and the war continued. So that allowed the war to continue and justified the war in their propaganda. All the charges against Milosevic were absolutely false, and it turned out he proved that during the trial. I got involved in 2000. I was asked by the American Association of Jurists to go to Belgrade to do an investigation onto his arrest, whether it was a political arrest or not. And I found out that it was, in my opinion. They let me speak to the new pro-NATO, pro-fascist government they had installed there after the war. And their Minister of Justice told me to my face that the charges against Milosevic were false, but they had to arrest him because the Americans demanded it. And if they did not, they were going to be bombed again. And then he was shanghaied and taken to The Hague in an RAF plane and framed up with false charges. And he spent the rest of his life defending himself against those charges till he died in his prison cell under mysterious circumstances. At the same time, I got asked to defend a Rwandan general who was the head of the national police in Rwanda. And if you accept the standard narrative in the media about Rwanda, you compare the government there to the Nazis, he'd be a Himmler, head of the Gestapo. But he was acquitted about 60 counts of genocide. And if you ask yourself, how can a man be acquitted of 60 counts of genocide who ran a national police force? Well, then you have to ask, was any of that narrative true? Because it wasn't. In fact, it was another, same as Yugoslavia. The Americans backed a proxy force like they're doing in Syria to attack a semi-socialist government, overthrow it, blame the government for war crimes, justify the installation of their puppet regime and keep it there since. And it's still under a dictatorship of Paul Kagame, who's murdered millions in the Congo since. That's how the system works. And I was lucky enough, or maybe unlucky enough, depending how you look at it, to get involved in those cases. And it's taken up the last 15 years of my life. And what I've learned about what goes on in the international criminal justice system is enough to disgust even the most optimistic person, because the people that say they're trying to control war crimes and stop war, in fact, the ones who are committing them, they're the ones who commit the war crimes, they're the ones who find scapegoats, and they're the ones who spend their lives covering up their crimes and blaming others for them.
Well, what do you make of the media coverage? Surely some of the things would have come out, like, for example, the mysterious death of Milosevic in custody. Well, most people look at that and think, well, surely he was poisoned in his jail cell.
Right. Well, I think he was personally. We don't have definite concrete proof of that, but there is a report. The only report done on his death was done by the NATO tribunal itself, the ICTY. It's called the Parker Report because there's a judge involved named Parker. And even in that report, which is very pro-NATO and tries to wash their hands of any responsibility, they indicate that there were two drugs in his body which should not have been there and can't be explained. It may have had a role in his death. One was a narcotic, and one was a drug which expedites the deterioration of other drugs in the body. They accelerate the breakdown of chemicals in the body. So, and he wrote a letter 3 days before he died, to the Russian embassy saying he was being poisoned, but he died before the letter could be acted upon. So I'm convinced he was poisoned. And the reason why is because he had won the case. He demolished the false charges against him. So they had one of three choices: let him acquit him and let him go back into politics, which would be a major blow to NATO and would totally prove to the world there was no justification for their war against Yugoslavia, and he would be a major force again, or falsely convict him, which would raise lots of questions because there's no evidence to convict him, or they kill him. They eliminate him, and that's what happened. They couldn't let him go, and they couldn't convict him, so he died.
So could you just go through briefly what the sort of charges were against him and how they fell apart?
Well, they first arrested him in Belgrade on corruption charges, claiming he'd stashed away billions. I was told by the investigating judge on that case that it was all false. He had nothing. He had no money. At The Hague, they charged him. The indictment changed over time. It was initially for some alleged massacres in Kosovo that his forces were alleged to have been involved in. That fell apart. And then they charged him with vague conspiracy charges of conspiring to create a greater Serbia, as if that's a war crime. It may be a political, I don't know, issue, but they alleged that's a war crime. In fact, it wasn't true in any event. But he demolished all these charges, and he had lots of support from very high people testifying on his behalf. And all the charges, like Jeffrey Nice, the British prosecutor, was lying pretty much every day in the court there. He said the Kosovo field speech in which he alleged Milosevic said he was pro-Serbian nationalist speech was actually a speech in favor of eclecticism and ethnic diversity. It's the exact opposite of what Jeffrey Nice said it was when you listen to it. So the whole case fell apart. There was nothing against it. They were just fake charges to justify the bombing. And the same with the Rwanda tribunal, by the way. That's another story.
Yeah, well, no, if you could go into that a little bit too, that would be fascinating. Thanks.
Well, in a nutshell, Rwanda, Bill Clinton said Rwanda in 1989 was the Switzerland of Africa. It was a very small country, dirt poor, no resources, just a small middle of Africa country living on agriculture.
Well, hang on, because basically, Switzerland is not poor. It's extremely wealthy.
It's not. Yes, well, they called it the Switzerland of Africa because despite its poverty, it had one of the best road systems, health systems, electrical systems, communication systems, school systems in Africa.
Okay, so a bit like Libya, maybe, because that was actually really high-quality country too.
Right, a bit like that, and it had help from Libya, North Korea, but also from West Germany, places like that. It was eclectic. It got support from socialist and non-socialist countries. But a lot of people studied in the USSR. But that was in 1990, the former aristocrats who had fled Rwanda during the revolution in 1959 wanted to take back power. The Americans asked the government of Rwanda to help them overthrow Mobutu in Congo, which they refused. So they went looking for somebody who would help them. And that was the aristocrats who wanted to take back power in Rwanda. And they got them to invade Rwanda. And they were all members then of Museveni's army in Uganda. They invaded Rwanda in 1990. And like the Contras in Nicaragua, spent 4 years creating terror all through Rwanda, assassinating people, murdering, massacring people everywhere for 4 years. There were various peace deals over that time. In 1994, they launched their final offensive with the help of the UN peacekeeping force, shot down the president's plane, killed him, massacred most of the people, blamed it all on the government, and then took power and have been in power ever since. And then proceeded with Museveni in Uganda to invade the Congo, which was the original plan, to break up the Congo into pieces so it could be exploited for minerals.
Did anyone really come to justice for all of this?
No, not one member of the... I mean, as in the Yugoslav tribunal, they selectively prosecuted only the government side, which was defeated, and framed them up on all sorts of false charges. The people that did a lot of the killing, the Rwanda Patriotic Front, and allied with their American, Canadian, and Belgian allies, none of them were charged. In fact, a document was just released this week, leaked. It's called as a top secret document dated 2003, in which the prosecution investigators list all the crime or some of the crimes committed by the Rwanda Patriotic Front, massacres of. And in a town called Masaka, 6,000 men, women, and children were executed in a couple of days there. And yet nothing's done about it. Whereas in Srebrenica, they called for Milosevic's head about Srebrenica, Mladic and Karadzic's head for Srebrenica, but 6,000 people in Masaka, nobody wants to know about it because it's an American, British, Canadian-supported regime that they put in power and did those crimes.
Now, I know you've also had a look at, quite a close look, actually, the Maidan protests back in, 2014?
2014, yeah.
February 2014. I mean, the entire centre of Kiev in Ukraine, one of the biggest countries in Europe, was basically on fire. I mean, there were fires burning just to keep people warm, but also they were setting fire to things as well. There was a mass protest which was organised right across Ukraine. People came to protest against the government, who they said was simply not bringing any taxes back to the regions, that they were collecting lots and lots of money from everybody and then using it for their own purposes rather than actually any kind of public spending on the regions. That was a pretty horrific gunfight that ended that, and there was effectively a kind of coup where the new government of Poroshenko took over literally over a weekend in February 2014. Right. So you also been keeping quite a close eye, Chris, I know, on the court cases that have followed that. We've heard virtually nothing about these in the Western press.
Yeah, it's what they did in Kiev was exactly what they did in Belgrade in 2000 when they overthrew Milosevic in a putsch organized by 5,000 mobsters and with NATO forces infiltrated into them, who attacked the city, attacked the Socialist Party headquarters and burned it, beat people up and just seized power and got the support of NATO immediately. And that's exactly what happened in Maidan. There's now a case going on in Kiev in which three Kiev policemen were charged by the Kiev regime with being involved. Burkat police officers were involved with murdering people. Their defense lawyer has found several Georgians who were part of a 50-man mercenary sniper team brought in to Kiev, and operating in teams of 10 people, were stationed on various buildings in the Maidan Square area, the Ukrainska Hotel and some other buildings. They said, they testified that they're the ones that did all the shooting. They shot police officers, they shot civilians, they shot all sorts of people just to create chaos and blame it on the government. And it turns out that
Now, just hang on a second, Chris, because this is pretty shocking, isn't it? The idea that the people who are protesting against the government would be shot dead and then that would be blamed on the government. But actually, the people who were doing the shooting were those who were trying to overthrow the government. It's a bit of a mind bender, isn't it?
Well, that's how dirty these people are. That's what they've been doing through all these wars. The people don't understand how that these people really are ruthless. They're willing to do almost anything, in fact, anything to get their way. And they don't care about ordinary people being killed. They don't care about ordinary citizens being killed. They couldn't care less.
But those people who they killed were also basically on the same side. If you want to, you know, characterize it like that, they were trying to overthrow the government, and they were shot for their pains.
Exactly. So a lot of people were caught, pulled into that protest movement for all sorts of reasons, although it's not as much as people think, but enough were there, and they got shot for being there, and they were used. And they were killed. It goes beyond that. They also say that an Italian journalist, Jen Michelesen, interviewed on Canale 5, Italian TV, three of these Georgians. And they said that on the 18th of February, they were taken to the Ukraine Hotel. And they met there with a member of the U.S. Army's 101st Airborne Division, who they said gave them orders what to do and who to shoot. And they were ordered to randomly target people, protesters and peace alike, to create fear and confusion, to implicate the government forces as the shooters, and to create the chaos necessary in order to undermine the government of Yanukovych. And they named the man, the American soldier, was going under the alias, maybe his real name, maybe an alias, Brian Christopher Boyinger. And he was later shown up as an advisor to the Ukrainian Georgian Legion, which is a fascist and pro-Nazi military formation. But so you have basically a NATO operation. This is very complicated, to import 50 mercenaries, set them up in sniper teams commanded by an American soldier whose rank we don't know. That means that's a NATO operation. That was very well planned out. That was planned out in detail ahead of time.
Would that have been planned at NATO headquarters in Brussels, somewhere like that?
It would have to be planned somewhere high up, because these people had to be brought in. They had to cross borders. They had to have papers.
Surely it could just be an operation by the Pentagon, or, you know, by the US if it's an American soldier giving the orders.
Not at that level. When you're overthrowing governments, you can't do that on the fly with amateurs. These people, this is a NATO operation. They were successful in overthrowing Yanukovych, installing a puppet regime, their own favorite regime. So it has to be a NATO operation. And the fact that we've now found out at least one American soldier was involved with these sniper teams, and the American ambassador must have known about it, because the Mr. Paraby, who was a member of the Ukrainian pro-Nazi government after the coup, was at the Ukraine hotel, knew who was there, knew who the shooters were, and was in communication with the U.S. ambassador all the way through those days.
So he also took over, didn't he, as the head of the National Security Council?
He did. And yet he's one of the guys that was involved in shooting these people.
What about others? I mean, you're talking about, you know, quite a lot of sniper teams. You've mentioned Georgians. Were there any other nationalities brought in, do you know?
Well, there may have been. We only have evidence right now of these Americans and these Georgians. The Canadian professor, Dr. Ivan Kachanovsky at the University of Ottawa, published an article in 2015 in which he said that our investigation concludes that the massacre was a false flag operation which was rationally planned and carried out with the goal of the overthrow of the government and seizure of power. It found various evidence of the involvement of an alliance of far-right organizations, right sector, Svoboda, oligarchic parties, Concealed shooters and spotters were located in at least 20 Maidan-controlled buildings or areas, and blah, 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 blah. And he goes on that we don't have concrete information about U.S. government involvement at that time, but we suspect it.
So, yeah. I mean, this is enormously important, isn't it, as this country is right up against Russia. We're now seeing, literally this week, the biggest NATO exercises for a generation, really since 1990 and the end of the Soviet Union, with NATO troops mobilising around the Baltic area and north of Ukraine, and also with NATO troops in Ukraine doing joint operations with them, almost as if they were already in NATO. Of course, Ukraine is not quite in NATO, and it would be worrying if it was because of the very strong neo-Nazi parties in Ukraine.
Yeah. Well, to me, Ukraine really is de facto a part of NATO, whether it's it adheres to the documents or not. Probably won't happen because of human rights concerns in certain quarters in NATO, but it's de facto a NATO satellite now. I mean, Canadian troops are there, British troops, French troops, American troops, and all sorts of so-called mercenaries who may or may not be mercenaries may still be connected to their original formations and their regular armies of those countries.
Okay, so NATO, we're hearing quite a lot about the wicked deeds of NATO. I mean, I'm starting as a British journalist to start to think, well, maybe I'm in the evil empire since we're part of NATO nowadays. What's NATO's right. ultimate aim? And I wonder, is there any kind of possibility to check what they're up to by our MPs here in Westminster?
Well, yeah, your MPs could ask direct questions and demand direct answers, but they don't do it. Same in Canada. Canada is one of the most loyal of the NATO allies to the United States. So we're supplying forces to every war they've fought in.
So what is their ultimate aim, Chris?
Well, the ultimate aim is NATO is, to me, the armed wing of the capitalists of the United States and its allied states. It's really using the might, the military might of the United States and its allies supporting it to get the will of the corporations that want to exploit the resources and the people of this planet. And it's quite clear that they want world domination and hegemony, and they won't put up with anybody resisting that. But in the Soviet Union was overthrown, and the Russians overthrew that and installed a capitalist regime there, thought they had their day and were going to be welcome. But they got slapped in the face. Once they started acting independent again after Yeltsin went out and Putin came in. Once the Russian nationalists came to power and began standing up to them for them, then suddenly everybody hates the Russians, according to NATO. And the same with China, because now the Americans and their allies can't control the world as they wanted to, and so they're creating as much chaos as they can to try and attain that aim.
Now, I mean, we all, I think, want to see justice for the war criminals. You know, whether or not he actually gets convicted and jailed, many people in Britain want to see Tony Blair stand trial. Is there any forum under which these kinds of cases might happen, some sort of alternative to The Hague, since it does seem that The Hague is captured, really, by NATO?
Yeah, there's no official state or international tribunal before which they could be brought. I don't see it happening, unless there's a world revolution somehow.
Well, look, I mean, I'm sort of hinting there, because I know there have been cases, is it in Malaysia, I think?
Well, you can have people's tribunals of various kinds set up. I took part in one in New York in 2000 and against NATO. Ramsey Clark led that one, and we indicted them and convicted them of crimes. And you can do the same in Britain. I mean, Bertrand Russell war crime, the Vietnam War, and a peace movement and the nuclear arms peace movement was very important in the 1960s and 1970s. I mean, that can be started again, but I'm not sure we have people of that stature who are willing to take part in these protest movements anymore. It's almost impossible to get the anti-war movement, peace movement going. And here in Canada, it seems to be taken over by these humanitarian interventionists who think that peace comes through war. Every time some nation is accused of, or some government is accused of mistreating its people, they're ready to jump in and save them. That means beating up everybody else in the way. That seems to be very popular. I was just talking about a peace movement here in Canada, and we got the objection of they don't want to hear from Vanessa Beely because she puts out so-called pro-Assad propaganda. I mean, this is the problems we face here, and probably the same in Britain. There's not the same, I don't know what's happened. The propaganda they control is more effective, or people have been disillusioned, or because the working class is more split up. I'm not sure exactly all the reasons why, but the peace movement is not like it was back in 2003 when in Toronto we had 300,000 people protesting the Iraq war. Where is that? And you had, I think, a million people in London, maybe more. Where are those movements now?
Well, one possibility is that the massive austerity has meant that there simply isn't the money to organise these sorts of things. Another one, of course, is that there's been infiltration. We just had some news over here in the UK that the Socialist Workers' Party, who are a really quite well-organised left-wing group, many of their meetings were mostly police infiltrators in the meetings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's been the way it has been. Well, they've been doing that to the left for, 100 years or more, so we can't be surprised at that. But, yeah, that doesn't really account for – we had those infiltrations back in the 60s and 70s, and yet the mass peace movements, anti-war movements then.
So what's your best guess as to why this dilution of the anti-war movement then?
Well, I think you're partly right about austerity. It's demoralized people. People are struggling to make a living and can't have other things to worry about going onto the street and getting involved in protests. Also, the fact that these very large protests we had against the Iraq war in 2003, I mean, they were massive. I think the biggest ever held. Didn't stop that war. And then we all could say we spoke out against it, but it didn't actually stop the war. And people will say, what's the point? We go out in the streets, they still do these wars. And so we can say we've done something. What have we done? Nothing, really. Well, I think it's something. I think we should express our disapproval of these wars, but the question, the good question is, does it really effectively stop these wars? And that's a good question. The Vietnam War protests, did they really stop the Vietnam War? Was it the defeat by the United States militarily on the field? And why did those protests take place? Mainly because people didn't want to be drafted. If there had been no draft as a professional army, maybe you wouldn't have had the Vietnam War protests either. It's a study in psychology and sociology, what all the reasons may be, but I think we have to keep struggling to try and start to keep the fire lit under the peace movement, the anti-war movement, because it's getting very dangerous. And with the withdrawal of the Americans from all these weapons treaties, it looks very, very dangerous. And as you say, the NATO exercises in the Baltic are a direct threat against, a provocation against Russia. I mean, they've been threatening the St. Petersburg area and Kaliningrad now for about 3 years.
But surely, I mean, nothing can happen there because it's got to be saber-rattling because Putin is a bit better defended than people like Gaddafi and Assad were. But actually, he's aligned with Assad now. But I'm thinking more about people like Saddam and Gaddafi. They were not well defended. Actually, the idea of taking on Putin in a similar fashion is surely it's suicidal.
Well, you would think so, but then when I was in Moscow in 2011 when they were attacking Libya, and it was very depressing. I was myself personally very, very depressed about that and still am. But in Moscow, the mood was very dark. I met with some Putin advisors and people linked with the party, and I spoke with the Communist Party people as well. The mood was across the board dark and depressed. And a deputy foreign minister told me that they regard the American leadership as completely irrational and therefore capable of anything. And they said, you'll see us dodging and weaving and bending and when you think we should be stronger and more firm. But you have to remember, we went through a war in which tens and scores of millions of our people were killed. We don't want to get into another one. We're going to try everything to avoid that kind of war. And you'll see us doing things which you don't approve of. But that's our one goal, to avoid nuclear war. I agree with them. I don't think the American leadership is rational. I mean, you would think that somebody in the military must be, but the way they're acting is completely irrational. And they're building up their forces on the Russian western borders constantly. They're threatening them constantly. And the same with China and the same with Iran. They're attacking them in Syria. They've actually attacked China. They bombed their embassy in the 1999 attack on Yugoslavia. They attacked China. They bombed the embassy. That's an attack on China. They don't care. I think we're in a very dangerous situation where the American leadership and are irrational, and they're just consumed with their own omnipotence.
I mean, could it be that they're actually working in the interests of another state? That they're not actually, you know, that America at some point might simply be jettisoned for what is effectively the interests of other countries?
Well, I think the Americans have their own deep interests. You can say that Israel has an influence on them, which is true, but we have to remember that Israel is a very small country and wouldn't survive for 5 minutes without the American support. I mean, the Israel is a very damaging influence in the Middle East. But how does it get its influence? Because of the weapons and the power given to it by the United States. I mean, it was defeated in the 73 war. Its entire air force was wiped out, but they were saved by the Americans flying over their planes and their pilots with Israeli markings to finish off the Egyptian army finally. But otherwise, they were dead. So the Americans saved them there, and they saved them all the time. But yes, they do have influence, and they have their own agendas, and they get they pressure the Americans to follow those agendas when they can. But the American leadership have their own deep interests, and they will jettison anybody if it's in their interests. As we see, they're doing it, damaging their NATO ally, Turkey. They slapped Europe in the face with all these tariffs. I mean, these are NATO allies, but they don't treat them like their friends.
What do you make of Brexit? Is it a storm in a teacup, or do you think this is quite significant, Chris?
Well, if overseas British had been allowed to vote, I would have voted for Brexit myself. Why? Because I'm a Marxist, and like many of us, when the EU was first formed, we thought the Marxist idea of the bigger the machinery, then when we take over, it'd be much easier to control the entire machinery of all of Europe. We could have a revolution in the entire European theater. But instead, what happened, the EU turned into really a neoliberal, semi-fascist organization, which is imposed on the working people across Europe, all sorts of austerity measures. It has just lowered the working standards, living standards of everybody in it, and was promising prosperity. So for myself, I thought if the British working class can escape that, they have a better chance of dealing with their local ruling class than they do trying to fight with the other Europeans, the entire dominant of German, French, British capitalist class all lumped together. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's what I think. So I think it's a good thing. And I think when they called the referendum, they expected to not to win. I don't think they wanted them to vote for Brexit. And when it looked like that's what's going to happen, they started panicking because they don't have a plan, obviously. But they're forced to go through with it. So it shows their stupidity, really, and their misreading of the people.
Chris, look, one of the big problems has been, we've touched on it quite a few times, is the press, the media. Is there any way, do you think, to, or even specific websites you'd recommend in order to try and get another more accurate view, a more balanced view of what's going on in the world? Because the trouble is, so much of our mass media is kind of corporate media, which is in bed with the problematic governments who are squirreling away their money in tax havens and see their readers as people to be told what to think and influenced rather than people who are appreciating decent journalism.
Yeah, well, there are many independent journals or blogs on, as you know, on, we can go to Counterpunch, we can go to Global Research in Canada, which is almost like a vacuum cleaner, information clearinghouse, and Greenville Post, 21st Century Y, just my one I write for, New Eastern Outlook, does some good stuff. And there are many small journals like that which people can access still on the net. Although the Washington Post has listed them all a couple of years ago and accused them all of being Russian agents, and therefore was threatening to shut them all down. So there are these journals, but I'm afraid to say that although when we read them and we talk to each other, we think everybody's reading them. The fact is, I live in a small town in Canada. Nobody reads them where I am. Everybody reads the mass newspapers and the usual mass TV channels. They get the news from CNN, the CBC, the BBC, the Guardian, and so on and so forth, and the Telegraph and the Daily Mail. That's where most people get their stuff, and they're too tired and too busy to look at anything else. I have the leisure every day of scanning all the major press from around the world, from Xinhua to the Cuban News to the New York Times to London Times to local news. I can sift through and try and find out what may be the truth among all that. And I can go to many, many blogs and independent journals and read their articles about people who really know what's going on. But most people don't have that luxury or don't have the time. So it's out there, and the more we create, the better it is. And your program is an important aspect of that. So I'm very happy to be on your program, to hope people encouraged to follow you for one thing. But I don't know. I wish there was some way that the labor parties of the world or the workers' parties of the world would form one major news organization like UPI or Reuters or something like that. But nobody's ever gotten together to do it, which is a big failing of the left movement, I think.
Okay, Chris Black, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. You can subscribe to our email list and listen the week before broadcast if you like, online at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Max Langer from Bristol University, talking about his Facebook page, the Bristol Bus Protest, and at Bristol's Buses, which is on Facebook and on Twitter. And you just heard then from Christopher Black, international criminal lawyer from Toronto in Canada, who writes for the New Eastern Outlook online journal and also globalresearch.ca. Thanks also to studio engineers Joss Chivers and Dave Bazenko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us at the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can talk to PRSC Arts Centre if you like on 0117 909 6897, or volunteer with us, or for hundreds of opportunities across Britain via the National Volunteering website. That's do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
No fighting, Shakira, Shakira.
I never really knew that she could dance like this. Hey. She make a man wanna speak Spanish. Como se llama?
Hey.
Bonita.
Hey.
Because
Shakira, Shakira.
Oh baby, when you talk like that, you make a woman go mad.
Hey.
So be wise,
hey,
and keep on,
hey,
reading the signs of my body. I'm on tonight, you know my hips don't lie, and I'm starting to feel it's right. All the attraction, the tension. Don't you see, baby, this is perfection.
Hey, girl, I can see your body moving,
and it's driving me crazy.
And I didn't have the slightest idea
until I saw you dancing.
Yeah. And when you walk up on the dance floor, nobody can add it to the way you move your body, girl.
And everything's so unexpected, the way you right and left it.
So you can keep on shaking it.
Never really knew that she could dance like this.
Yeah.
She make a man wanna speak Spanish. Como se llama? Bonita.
Shakira, Shakira.
Oh baby, when you talk like that, you make a woman go mad. So be wise and keep on reading the signs of my body. I'm on tonight, you know my hips don't lie, and I'm starting to feel you, boy. Come on, let's go real slow. Don't you see, baby, I see us perfect. I know I'm on tonight, my hips don't lie, and I'm starting to feel it's right. All the attraction, the attention. Don't you see, baby, Shakira, this is perfection. Shakira. Oh boy, I can see your body moving. Half animal, half man. I don't really know what I'm doing, but you seem to have a plan. My will, I'm self-restrained. Have come to fail now. See, I'm doing what I can, but I can't. So you know that's a bit too hard to explain.
Can dance like this. Hey. She make a man wanna speak Spanish. Yeah. Como se llama?
Sí.
Bonita.
Sí.
Casa.
Shakira, Shakira.
Oh, baby, when you talk like that, hey. You know you got me hypnotized. Hey. So be wise and keep on beating the size of my body. Yeah.
Señorita, feel the conga. Let me see you move like you come from Colombia.
Mira, en Barranquilla se baila así,
¡sí! En Barranquilla se baila así.
Yeah, she's so sexy, AMF fantasy. A refugee like me back with the Fugees from a third world country. I go back like when Pac carried crates for Humpty Hump. We lead a whole club dizzy.
Why the CIA wanna watch us?
The Colombians and Haitians, I ain't guilty, it's a musical transaction. Bobo, zobo, no more do we snatch rope. Refugees run the seas cause we on our own boat.
I'm on tonight, my hips don't lie. And I'm starting to feel you, boy. Come on, let's go, real slow. Baby, like this is perfecto. Oh, you know I'm on tonight. My hips don't lie. And I'm starting to feel it's right. The attraction, the tension. Baby, like this is perfection.
No fighting.
No fighting.